Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is May 19th, 2021. We have two oral arguments on our calendar this morning, in addition to some non-orals. Marshall, will you call the first case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Flory, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding.
Good morning. And let me just go over a couple of things. We are doing this via zoom.gov, but the rules are very much as they are in our physical courtrooms. Each of you, beginning with counsel for appellant, will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I ask you to introduce yourself when you begin your arguments, because we do record these and make them available on our website. That way everyone's identified. You will notice a time clock on the gallery view, and that will keep track of your time. We will ask you to also keep your videos on during the entire argument, but when you're not speaking, to mute yourself. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is Nahid Abul Hassan. Last name is spelled as A-B-U-E-L-H-A-S-S-A-N. I'm here this morning to present an oral argument based on an appeal I filed on behalf of the appealant who's also the petitioner in the district court. This case has been a mess. Right now, the district court held Mr. Stanton in contempt of court, and it's not clear why the court did that. The court did not follow the standard to hold someone in contempt of court. Mr. Stanton, on November 11th or 12th, filed a motion because he received information that he would be receiving inheritance. He asked to stay 9 provisions of the general decree. The motion was denied by a stamp, just saying denied. No regular motion hearing date was provided. We ended up filing the motion again. The district court denied it again. At the same time, the district court keeps saying, you don't comply with court orders. When we asked the court to assist Mr. Stanton by giving clear direction, so Mr. Stanton would not be looked at as violating court orders.
So if I may, counsel, you know, you're saying, well, the district court wasn't clear, but when I look at, you know, when I look at your brief, you know, I am somewhat mystified. I mean, this was what we call a hop hearing, right? And yes, there are 8 factors that the district court, you know, must look at, or that so the district requirements. And so I would frankly expect kind of you to be telling me which, not just saying here are the facts, but to say, here's why this requirement was or wasn't met. And I don't see that. So could you look at those factors and tell me specifically what conduct, where did the district court fall short in examining those factors?
Yes, after I stated the many, many motions filed by respondent and withdrawn, or she finally agreed with me, in my argument, I detailed how contempt of hearing should be determined. And I cited Erickson v. Erickson, which gives good guidance about what the court should look at in order to hold someone in contempt or not. If I may take a second to get to the brief here.
So which factor are you looking at? Are you saying this wasn't the act to be defined, wasn't clearly defined? Because that seemed pretty clear to me.
Okay, first, the court has to give notice. My client never got a clear notice from the court. We appeared at the first hearing, and the court said, pay all the financial obligations or I will hold a hop hearing. the motion for contempt was not about the financial obligation, because at that time, my client had a motion for amended findings pending before the court. So left the hearing without knowing what, I'm sorry.
So by the, but moving to the March 13th hearing on your client's, the allegation was failure to follow the disclosure provision of the decree. You had notice of that hearing. Is that fair to say?
No, Your Honor. We had the first hearing on December 17th. That was based on my client filing a motion for a stay. On the 3rd, he filed a motion for a stay. On December 6th, opposing counsel filed a motion for contempt. We moved the court for a stay instead of waiting for an order from the court if his motion for a stay would be granted or not. And if he doesn't comply after that, then you can bring a motion for contempt. But every time we ask the court to assist us to comply with orders, opposing counsel files a motion saying no, hold him in contempt, just because we moved the court for some assistance. So the
December counsel, it seems to me that at least then by December 6, 2019, your client was aware that the basis for contempt was the failure to disclose the inheritance as required by the dissolution judgment, correct?
No, it wasn't clear. We had a motion that included everything, like a kitchen sink.
Sure, but you understood at that point that that was one of the issues. Yes. So then my question, I have a kind of a basic question about sort of where we're at. I'm looking at the amended, the order from July 2020 that you included in your addendum. And I see the order stating that your client is in constructive civil contempt for failing to make that disclosure about the inheritance. Where are we at now? Did your client ever make that disclosure?
Multiple times. First, by his motion for a stay, my client disclosed that he was anticipated to receive his first distribution of inheritance on November 14th. That by itself was a disclosure. No one knew because the inheritance assets were being liquidated. So once he got a war out, he disclosed that fact by his motion for a stay. The court denied it. We filed it again. The court denied it. We filed it for the third time. Respondent counsel immediately turned around and said, oh, contempt, he didn't disclose. But when we disclosed by the motion itself multiple times, he is getting money. He is going to get money soon. Then we go to the December 17 hearing and the court doesn't mention anything about the disclosure. The court ordered him to pay attorney's fees, all financial obligations due to the respondent within 60 days, or the court will hold him in contempt. So the issue at the hearing itself had nothing to do with the disclosure. It was a huge mess. We leave the court saying that he had to pay in 60 days while we have a motion pending. There is a procedure. If you denied my motion for amended finding, I'm not going to turn around and pay because I still have a second shot to appeal that denial of amended finding. You can't tell someone that you're not going to the Court of Appeals. And if you do, I'll hold you in contempt. That's exactly what happened here. That's exactly what happened here. Then we get a proposal. Then we get an order telling the court, telling my client to pay everything within 30 days. And that order came out when the 30 days expired already, 2 weeks before that. How my client is going to comply with an order setting up a deadline that passed 2 weeks ago? Then we-
Can I come back to my question about notice by the March 13th hearing? You had notice of the contempt issue, correct?
No, I'm coming back to that, we did it. Because the order first said, pay money. Then it says, pay within 60 days. Then it says, pay within 30 days. Then it says, we're appointing a receiver. My client testified at the hearing.
Counsel, if I may, you had notice of the requirement to disclose, right? Because that's really the basis, isn't it? What we're talking about here?
Yeah. We did know that, but we didn't know what exactly my client had to do. Did he pay money? Did he pay? Did he provide disclosure? Does he wait for a receiver? Counsel kept changing her motions over and over and over. So my client did not receive clear direction. Is the court going to give him an order approving him to post security? Is the court going to ask him to pay money? Is the court going to ask him to give a copy of the check he received to a receiver or to the opposing counsel? We did not have clear guidance. What that disclosure mean?
Counsel, if I may, there are two other issues you raised in your brief, and I have a question about each of them. If we could turn to that for a moment.
Sure.
First of all, on the IALTA issue, do you agree that on February 22nd of this year, the district court issued an order stating that the IALTA disclosure directive was moot? Did that, do you agree that happened?
It happened, but I don't agree it's moot.
You do not agree it's moot. Would you tell me why you do not believe this is moot?
Because counsel filed all these motions and changed her mind about them. And at the same time, she's asking for attorney's fees. Given that counsel desperately wanted to get the IALTA issue to be considered moot, but yet not withdrawing her motion for attorney's fees for the same thing, then it's not moot. Why my client pays attorney's fees for something?
So I just want to make sure I understand it. So from your perspective, the IALTA issue is not moot because Respondent's counsel is still asking for attorney's fees to incurred to address the issue. Is that fair to say?
That's it. That's exactly it.
I'm just one that does bring me to my attorney's fees question, if I may.
Yes.
So I want to, as I read your brief, you're not challenging the amount of attorney's fees. Is that correct? You seem to be saying, and once again, I just want to understand your position, that the respondent's counsel also engaged in unwarranted conduct, which would be the basis of conduct-based attorney's fees. So therefore, your client shouldn't be responsible for them. Is that fair? Is that what you're basically telling us?
That's what we're asking for. And we asked the court to award this attorney's fees based on the respondent's counsel conduct. The court denied ours.
But did you appeal? I mean, is that denial part of the appeal before us?
We don't want attorney's fees to be awarded to my client. We want this court to reverse that award for attorney's fees because it was all based on misconduct by respondent's counsel. She filed 7-8 motions and then she kept changing her mind about the same motion. The reason is the IALTA. I can't give my IALTA statement every day to provide if my client really has money in my trust account and I can't do anything with the trust account and money in the trust account when I was waiting for the court to give me an order to post the same money in security with the court administration. So instead of giving me that order, counsel kept objecting to my motion to post security with court administration. Yet she motioned the court to order me. And I can't even prove every day that money is there unless I take a screenshot of my bank account every day. Giving a statement, monthly statement, doesn't mean the next day the money is there or not. So that was a clear abuse of judicial system. And if we go through everything, Your Honor, here, this whole going to court and filing 6, 7, 8 motion and changing her mind about them is just to rack up attorney's fees. My client gave the disclosure multiple times. He even gave a check. We have a second motion right now, pending an appeal, about the same disclosure, which we gave multiple times. This is just a vehicle to rack up attorney's fees. Why? Because from day one, the respondent and her counsel have been targeting my client's inheritance. And what did she do with the disclosure? Nothing. We gave her a copy of the first check. We gave her a copy of the second check. We gave her a trust document showing distribution from here until November 2026. Yet we're still back in court for the same issue. This is to rack up attorney's fees. This is abuse of the judicial system. My client did nothing wrong. The court never gave him guidance. The court never told him what to do because opposing counsel kept changing her own request to court. And for that, I asked the court to dismiss, actually overturn or reverse this ruling because my client due process of law was violated. My client didn't have a chance. The opposing counsel didn't even prove he acted in bad faith because at the outset, when we had the evidentiary hearing, my client said, I didn't know who to give the disclosure to. I came here and said, give it to respondent counsel. I came here again, you said, give it to a receiver. And you haven't appointed a receiver. And then we get the receiver appointed and then opposing counsel moves the court to say, I don't want a receiver. This is a huge mess, it's to rack up attorney's fees. My client should not be responsible for paying attorney's fees for this mess created by opposing counsel. And with that, I yield my time back.
Thank you. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you decide to use it. Counsel will respond and we'll turn to you.
I'm sorry. My name is Edward Rooney. May it please the court. I'm representing the respondent, Megan Curran. I don't believe there's been any error in the trial court, of course. As I mentioned in the respondent's brief, in this case, the statement of the case is really the statement of the operative facts that relate to this appeal. And I've tried to state them as clearly and comprehensively as I could in the brief. First of all, with respect to contempt, I don't believe there's been an appealable contempt order from the trial court. And I say that because, first of all, whatever findings of contempt the trial court made were conditional, that the respondent could avoid punishment by delivering the disclosure that two provisions in the judgment and decree required. And in fact, he did.
Counsel, could I just ask about that? I mean, I can understand that your position, but given this court's June 17th order that there was a final order on the contempt issue, isn't that law the case? Don't we really have to move to the merits on this?
Well, I think it's up to the court whether it's the law of the case. As I said in a brief, court made that order on an incomplete record. It did not have the transcript. And I think it's clear from the transcript that what the court in that June 17th order relied on, namely that the award of attorney fees was the punishment that rendered this an appealable order, is inaccurate. It's an inaccurate statement of what a trial court was doing. The trial court's award of attorney fees was for a gamut of post-judgment and decree proceedings and not strictly for contempt. But I'm happy. I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Judge. Are you?
It's okay, I just wanted to interrupt you. But can you point to something in the law of the case doctrine that would suggest that, you know, if, as you're suggesting, the court got it wrong, we say, well, then let's try it again. I'm still struggling to why we don't need to move to the merits on this.
Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because I think it can be defended on the merits, but I guess in appellate practice, I'm not so sure, but I know in trial court, temporary orders are always subject to later orders and final orders from a trial court. And I don't know why it should be different in an appellate court, particularly when one can point to defects in the record or absences or omissions from the record that were before the appellate court when it had to render its initial jurisdictional decision. But turning away from whether this is appealable and assuming arguendo that it is, it was a proper and sound exercise of the trial court's discretion. And if you look at those factors that the court raised, the eight factors, I can actually only see seven, but that's probably my error. But the question, did the trial court have subject matter jurisdiction over this divorce case? Yes. Was the obligation that the party had been required to perform clearly stated? Yes, it was stated in two conclusions of law of the judgment and decree, 11G and 21. Did the party have notice of the court's decree? The initial, I think it was a hearing in January of 2020 where Mr. Stanton testified that he did have notice of the judgment and decree. Did he have notice? Was the adversely affected party had applied to the court for relief? Yes, we made a motion for finding contempt. That requirement, was satisfied. Was there due notice of the hearing to be conducted, given to the appellant or the petitioner? Yes, I mean, that was an issue in conflict in the trial court. course, it seems to me that notice issues are waived when the party who is entitled to notice shows up and appears at the hearing with counsel. But even aside from the waiver issue, the civil rules do not require an order to show cause. And the court directed counsel as an officer of the court to get an admission of the order to appear, an admission of the notice of the initial hearing. And the petitioner, the appellant here, participated in both the initial hearing and in the HOP hearing. And did the court give the opportunity for the contemnor to purge the contempt? And yes, court made it clear over and over, all you have to do is provide the disclosure that the judgment and decree requires. And that was a point of contention and still remains a point of contention in this case.
And I was going to ask you about that, Mr. Rooney, because that I'm looking at, I guess, the amended order from July of 2020, which just, you know, baldly states that the petitioner is in constructive civil contempt for failing to comply with conclusion of law number 21. I don't see any purge conditions at all in this order. And so is there any subsequent order that says that the appellant is not in contempt any longer?
No, there is not.
And
on the other hand, excuse me.
No, and is it your position that in fact the appellant has still not made the disclosure required by conclusion of law 21?
No, he has. That was one of the reasons why I said this is not an appealable order, because there was no punishment. It's true.
But there's no order that says you're no longer in civil. My problem is there's no order that I'm aware of that says he is no longer in contempt. And don't we need that at some point?
I wish it were in the record, but it seems to me even absent that order, you can draw a reasonable inference from the fact that the respondent, this party moving for contempt, never came back to seek any punishment or enforcement. I can't go outside the record, but if we had not gotten the required disclosure, we would have asked the court for relief to make sure it happened. And so, but in any event, the requirements of the HOP hearing were met. The fact of the matter is we are no longer seeking enforcement on that disclosure that was due for the November 19 trust distribution. And it would seem to me a reasonable inference that if we're up here litigating about everything, and my client has had to spend a lot of money seeking enforcement, if she still hadn't gotten the required disclosure, she'd be here. But once again, I'm trying to make an inference because we don't have a specific acknowledgement in the record that the disclosure was made. I think we had a full fair hearing on contempt. The contempt issue, at least as far as the 2019 mandatory disclosure, because there's an annual distribution for the trust, that mandatory disclosure has been met.
Well, based on your acknowledgement that there's no contempt issue remaining before, I mean, what relief do you think this court should grant on that, considering that contempt seems to be no longer an issue?
It should grant no relief. I mean, it is, as a practical matter, it's as moot as the IOLTA disclosure is as a legal matter. If we got what we wanted from the trial court, which was leverage to get the mandated disclosure made. So I don't think there was an ample record supporting that order, and there's been no punishment. And case law in Minnesota is a contempt order with no punishment is not appealable. But once again, even if it is appealable, there's no error to be found respecting the contempt order. Turning to attorney fees, I think the court needs to understand in context that right now there are three appeals in various stages in this case pending in this court, and there is a proceeding for an award of attorney fees pending in the Supreme Court for a petition for further review that was denied. This case, in the judgment and decree in finding of fact 23, the court recognized that the respondent, my client, had a well-founded fear that the petitioner, the appellant here, would continue to use proceedings to harass, intimidate the respondent. And that can also point in the record to the affidavit that Becky Rooney filed on February 6th, 2020 for an award of attorney fees. It's document number 309. In paragraph 7, she cited the expert opinion of both of the neutral psychologists in this case who said, Mr. Stanton can be expected to continue to do this sort of thing. The two attorney fee affidavits that Ms. Rooney filed, which were documents, I think, 309 and 383, if I'm not mistaken, both meticulously state all of the things that she had to do simply to enforce the obligations of the judgment and decree or to resist the respondent's, or excuse me, the appellant's motion, or to deal with the fact that the appellant's former attorney had brought attorney lien proceedings that she had to be at least monitoring to make sure that they didn't prejudice the appellant's issue interests. Those affidavits are significant also in that they point out all of the things that she is not seeking an award of attorney fees for, which would be just the normal housekeeping after a judgment and decree to get certain things implemented. She only had to bring on motions for attorney fees for behavior on the part of the appellant, which was an obstruction or a refusal to abide by the obligations under the judgment and decree. The other thing that I will say respecting attorney fees, the trial court's two orders characterized both of those as conduct-based fees, and I think they clearly are. And that's a discretionary issue with the trial court. It can do that. But on the other hand, the record clearly shows that the same disparity of wealth that existed in the justified the $200,000 award in the trial court that was upheld by this court, and the respondent's need for legal counsel to protect her interests and effectuate the gains that she gave in the judgment decree existed. And with those three predicates for awards of conduct-based fees, that's a mandatory award. That is, of needs-based fees. That is a mandatory award. And even if the court were to have second guess about trial court's discretion in awarding these fees as conduct-based fees, they still are entirely called for as needs-based fees for my client to protect her interests. I do think, I don't see how the IOLTA disclosure issue can be anything but moot. It was a temporary situation when counsel said she had this money in her trust account and that she would disclose it, records of it to the court. This was before we had set up any kind of legitimate security for these appeal stay. And once that security was provided, we were not opposing a stay. We just wanted adequate security. The respondent was entitled to figure out how real is this claim of money in the trust account. But once it became clear that that wasn't going to be the source of the security for the appeal stay, there was simply no reason to appeal it. And that's why in November of 2020, in a phone conference, Ms. Rooney called it to the court's attention, said that's really moot in light of the security that's been posted. And the court agreed. So I think the best thing that I can do have done for this court is to try to lay out the statement of the case as meticulously as I can in the appellant's brief. And unless I'd be happy to address any questions the court has, but otherwise I don't believe I need to say anything further.
Any further questions from the panel? Well then, counsel for appellant, we will turn to you.
He's mooted.
I remind that the order for contempt was issued on June 17th. My client not only disclosed everything to respondent counsel, but also filed the same with court as of March 19th. The court came back 3 months later to hold him in contempt for something that the court, my client shared with the court itself. The same day, the court ordered him, or the court ruled that he's in contempt. The court issued another order granting the same request my client made over and over to post security with court administration. Two orders, one day.
If I may, it sounds like you and Mr. Rooney both agree, though you differ on the dates, but at this time, your client has complied with the July 24, 2020 order. Is he? What from I'm your saying- perspective, has your client complied with the July 24, 2020 order?
My client complied even before opposing counsel filed any motion for contempt. Okay. By closing to the court in November of 2019 that he was getting money from his inheritance. That was made. What we are challenging here, there shouldn't have been a contempt or constructive contempt issued against my client because there was no basis for it. And the only reason it's being used is to award the respondent counsel more attorney's fees. And if we
if I can, counsel, so what you're saying is really this appeal gets down to whether the district court abuses discretion awarding the attorney's fees. Is that fair to say?
Yes, because the finding of facts the court made to justify attorney's fees are not supported by the record. And in my statement of the case, I detailed how many times the person who's been bringing us back to court is the respondent. How many motions the respondent filed, and then she changed her mind about them, but we pay attorneys. The motion, she challenged my finding of fact motion, amended finding of fact motion, claiming it was motion for reconsideration. She made the same argument at the level of this court. This court didn't agree with her. She makes frivolous motion. She files frivolous motion. And the finding of fact claim, I did that. I only filed one motion signed by my client, affidavit. One. That's the only motion I filed. The rest is me challenging the not following the rule about the time of when to file motion. My memorandum of law I filed with the district court is to address why respondent's counsel does not follow the law. My client should not be expected to argue the law. I do it through a memorandum of law. And the court said, because I do that, my client somehow acted in bad faith. At some point, the court said, my memorandum of law was untimely when I filed it to address the motions that were untimely filed. I can't act ahead of respondent. I object to her late filing, and the court says my filing was late. There has the records. In this case, if the court is going to read the transcript, will show the person who added up attorney's fees here is the respondent. And all the cases the person the if we go to housekeeping, what behavior? My client only defended the frivolous motion, the respondent kept filing. Once we respond to a motion, we're acting in bad faith. So it's either we agree with all the violation of rule of procedure or practice, or if we respond and say this is wrong, we're acting in bad faith. I listed all the nonsense in my statement of the case, and if the court goes and reads it, the court will find out the only thing we did is to defend ourselves. Again, it's not properly bringing motion before the district court. That's not bad faith. For that reason, we asked for attorney's fees and it got denied, and the court made findings that not even supported by the evidence. And I asked the court to reverse this whole issue.
Well, thank you both for your arguments and briefing. The matter is taken under advisement and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.